Welcome to Point Loma. It's a beautiful Sabbath day here, unusually overcast, but it's beautiful. Thank you, worship team. Really always enjoy our time of singing praises and worshiping God with our lips and our hearts. The book of Acts, of course, as you've discovered by now, is a very brief sketch of the life of Paul. It doesn't go really into great detail, but it shows the amount of travel that Paul did in his ministry, and it also reveals some of the heartbreaks and the trials that he went through. In the last couple of chapters, we're not going to bother to go into great detail, but we can pretty much sum the last few chapters up as simply Paul appearing time and time again before tribunals, before courts, before judges, various groups, such as Felix and Festus and the high priest and the Sanhedrin, and the list goes on. And we find that throughout this entire ordeal, Paul has only one goal to accomplish, and that is to continue to share the good news of salvation, to continue to give his testimony of what God has done in his heart. Each time you find him giving his testimony, he of course tells of his experience in finding Jesus Christ. Of course, Christ found him, but he tells this story over and over again, very much a part of his journey in life. This time where he met at the crossroads of life and had to make a decision to either follow Christ or to reject and to continue on in his ways of persecuting and killing Christians. Obviously, telling that story laid open not only Paul's life for observation and judgment, but also it laid open the lies and the deception of the religious leaders of that time period. So they didn't want him to tell his story. They didn't want him to give his testimony, because when he gave his testimony, it revealed much of their coercion and their legalism and all the things that they did to maintain power and control among the people. As I studied this the last two chapters, actually, I couldn't help but be reminded that the problems that the Apostle Paul had as a pastor, as a missionary, as an evangelist, are many of the same issues and same problems that we deal with here, even in the modern world today. And as I reflected on that, I realized that legalism and perfectionism has always been around. As long as you find human beings, you will find in the midst of that group of people or that community or that church or that family, you will always find that dark spot, that part of human nature that tries to take control and manipulate and judge other people. I also discovered that legalism and perfectionism is not necessarily a religious thing. We often think of it as something in the context of church life or church communities. We often accuse other groups of people as being legalistic or perfectionistic. But I began to reflect on the real, what is it that motivates, what drives legalism, what drives perfectionism? And I came up with a number of answers. I won't pursue or detail all of them, but I found one common denominator, and that is that in most legalists, both religious and non-religious, there is a desire to control other people. And it's that desire, that need to control, that drives a person to judge others and to condemn them for what they're doing wrong or doing different than what the legalist person believes. In this story of Paul, we find, of course, his confrontation there in Jerusalem. Going to Jerusalem, everybody told him, don't go there, Paul. It's dangerous. You shouldn't go. And Paul went anyways. He knew very well what he was going into. let's not be fooled into thinking that Paul was just naive and just sort of wandering into this this situation in Jerusalem. He knew very well that he was stepping right into the lion's den. He was going to the very source of this legalism that had hounded his ministry for many, many years. Every church, every place he went to, these people were there to judge him, to try to kill him, to try to get him put in prison. They tried to discredit him in front of others. And so Paul, I would like to imagine that somewhere in Paul's heart, he decided, hey, you know what? It's time to confront the beast right in the face. I'm going straight up to where the source of this legalism is that's been hounding my ministry, and I'm going to stand toe-to-toe, face-to-face, and we are going to have it out. Because you find that in the story, Paul is ready to answer every accusation. He goes overboard. He goes to a great extent to make sure that he breaks none of the rules of the legalists, even to the point of where he purifies himself for a number of days to make sure that when he went to the temple, that they could not accuse him of bringing impurity into the temple. He did everything he could to make sure that he abided by the rules that they had set. The rules he knew, by the way, because he'd been raised in a very highly legalistic society, in a home, and also became a Pharisee himself. So in his heart, he knew exactly what he was doing. And we find that, sure enough, he was arrested. He was taken before the high priest, he was taken before the Sanhedrin, he was taken before the religious leaders and the lawyers of that time period. And they tried hard to find something to pin on him so that they could say, this man deserves death. By the way, they'd already come to that conclusion before he was even tried. They had decided that he needed to die for the good of the country. You'll find that in the passage that we had here today. In fact, this is towards the end of the trials. Paul appeals eventually. He appeals to Caesar. And if you appeal to Caesar, all other trials, all other court cases are dropped. And you're going straight for the big boy. And you're going to stand in front of the Supreme Court, if you please, of the United States of America. Imagine going and testifying in front of a Supreme Court. Would any of you like to do that? Probably not. Martita might do pretty good in front, though. She does that for a living. But the point is that most of us, when we consider, we think about going into the midst of a group of people who are going to look through the books and they are going to judge our actions or judge what we did or what we haven't done. They are going to be legalistic. They are going to make sure that we have stuck true to every single one of the principles, every single one of the truths, every single one of the laws that the society was ruled by. Paul wasn't afraid of any of that, once again, because he had been a legalist and a perfectionist, probably the best of them. That's why he was going around persecuting Christians. Get rid of those Christians. They're breaking the law. And so he had to make sure that he was the best of the best. I'd be curious, I'm not going to ask for a show of hands, think about yourself. Are you, by any chance, could you be a legalist or a perfectionist? Chances are that all of us have a little bit of that tendency, okay? One way to find out whether you have that tendency or not is when somebody challenges what you believe. What is your response? To rear up, get defensive, start yelling and banging on your Bible, start quoting texts till your face is blue. What is your response to someone challenging what you believe, the core of your belief system? Legalists don't like to be wrong. They don't like anyone to challenge the foundation or the basis of what they believe. But once again, as I said earlier, legalism and perfectionism is not necessarily a religious dynamic, even though it shows itself up quite often. And I'm sure if you're not someone who tends to be legalistic or perfectionistic, I'm sure that you have met someone who is, maybe related to someone who is. And so at some point in your life, you have probably been confronted by that individual. I remember a church that I pastored early on in my ministry, and there was one person in particular who was bigger than life, both physically and, you know, emotionally. They tended to believe that they were sort of the more important person in the congregation, and they made themselves known everywhere. I remember, I may have told you the story before, but I remember studying for about 8 months with a young couple who were taking theology, actually, at a seminary not too far from where I pastored. And they were convicted of the gospel, and they were convicted to decided to follow Jesus, and they wanted to be rebaptized. And so I was willing to do that, and they were baptized both together. And they were a beautiful Christian couple. They believed in the gospel. They followed the word of God. It was their guide in life. They had two little girls, and they had committed themselves to being pastors, and both husband and wife. And so when I baptized them, it wasn't long until, because of their natural talent and gifts, they were wonderful Bible teachers. They began to teach Bible class on Saturday mornings. And it was one of the bigger classes, and it grew because they were obviously blessed, and the Spirit was certainly using their gifts. But it wasn't long until someone came to me and sat down in my office and said, "I have something serious to talk to you about." And I said, "Okay, what is it?" "Well, I have a problem with the couple that you baptized and who are now very prominent teachers in Sabbath school." I said, "Oh, really?" I said, "You know, is there something they're teaching that maybe I need to just sit down with?" No, their teachings are fine. In fact, sometimes I like to go to their class, but I have a hard time going to their class because the wife wears a wedding ring." And I thought, you know, I hadn't even noticed, quite frankly. And so I had to actually check for myself. And sure enough, she had a wedding ring on. But I remember this person constantly bringing this topic up in board meetings, bringing it up in my presence, bringing it up with other elders and other people in the church. And it became quite annoying, actually, because in reality they were trying to undermine this lovely couple's ministry. And unfortunately, it wasn't too long after that I was called away to another congregation. But I remember a number of years later going back and talking to some of the people of that congregation. Eventually, they forced these two to leave the church. And at this point, I have no idea where they are, where God has led them. But they left. And it wasn't long after that I found out that this couple, this lady who was complaining about the other woman wearing a wedding ring, I found out through a family member who was a family member of this lady who was complaining, that she quite regularly went to Las Vegas to gamble. And I thought to myself, doesn't make sense, does it, to argue and to fuss about a wedding ring when, in fact, in your own closet you have something that is very, it doesn't follow the teachings of God's Word. And I realized at a very young age that, once again, legalism shows up in many places, in many shapes, in many forms. And in the case of Paul here, it seems to me that he walked right into the very, like I said, the lion's den of legalism. And as a result of that, over and over, and this is interesting to me to follow, Paul has the opportunity to not just share the good news of the gospel to the common people in the streets or in the temple, but he is brought before the high-ranking officials of each area that he goes into. And so he is given a wonderful opportunity. Yes, he is in chains, but he's given the opportunity to share his testimony over and over with Agrippa, with Felix, and eventually on to Rome. But it's amazing how in his ministry God was able to use the difficult times. the hardships of his life, the times where he might just sit down and say, I give up. You know, if God can't keep me out of prison, if he can't keep the Pharisees and the Sadducees from hounding my ministry, I'm just going to give up. Instead, it seemed to energize him even more. And so we find here in these few chapters long accounts. I call it, well, they're sermons, actually. But they are the story Paul repeats over and over in his story of when he found Jesus and then what Jesus did for him and what Jesus was doing in his life. So the first century church was not void. In fact, if you look at Acts 15:1 and the book of Galatians and also in Antioch, the legalists were hard at work in trying to divert the attention of those who were listening to Paul's preaching, trying to divert them onto a road of perfectionism and legalism. And as I looked at this passage of Scripture, chapter 24, verse 1 through 5, let's just read it briefly. It's a very short one, but let's take a look at this, because we find in this passage some common denominators of those who would seek to undermine the gospel, those who would seek to enforce legalism and perfectionism upon God's people. 5 days later, the high priest, Ananias, by the way, I could tell you a whole lot about Ananias and his family. They had a lot at stake there in the temple. If the temple were to somehow be compromised or the worship in the temple was to cease, they would cease to be millionaires. You see, their wealth, the high priest's wealth, the family of the high priest's wealth was determined by the offerings that were brought to the temple and the money that was given as tithes and offerings, and they became wealthier and wealthier and wealthier. I mean, I've shared this before, but right next to the temple complex was a huge industrial complex that included preparing sheep skins to be used in many different ways. The wool from the sheep was used to make clothing. It was dyed also there, many different colors. They had vats where they would dye this. The meat of the sheep that were offered as sacrifices was used and sold in the marketplace for a profit. The sheep that people brought to be offered as sacrifices were often deemed imperfect, and so they were sold sheep that were perfect, that were without flaw, and so people lost money. There were money changers. Jesus rebuked them. Remember how he came into the temple and he said, you know, this is my Father's house and you guys have turned it into a den of thieves, and he overturned the tables of the money changers. Everything that happened in the temple was a profit that went into the pocket of the high priest's family. So they had a lot to lose. And Paul, well, first Jesus, challenged what they were doing and created an environment where the high priests and the religious leaders at that time were afraid they would lose their income, and so they put Jesus to death. Along comes Paul, preaching the same thing, and they wanted him to be put to death. Paul, of course, knew the laws of the land, and he used that knowledge and that wisdom to keep moving up the ladders, you might say, until he reaches the Supreme Court. He just kept saying, well, I'm a Roman citizen, you can't beat me. I'm a Roman citizen, you can't imprison me. I'm a Roman citizen, you must take me to Caesar. So he's getting closer and closer to that final court case. But in the process of doing that, what is he doing? Constantly sharing the good news of salvation. Constantly preaching the gospel. Now that might say something for us today. It should say to us that even when at times when we think or we feel that we are ineffective, or that we have our lives are going in the wrong direction, that our lives are messed up, that we're at the lowest point in our lives, always remember the example of Paul. He could have easily sat back and said, listen, I give up. I've done my best. These people are hopeless. They're putting me in prison. They're trying to kill me. I just give up. No. He saw it as an opportunity. Every situation in our lives is an opportunity to share the good news of salvation. Don't lose heart. Be faithful and true as Paul was. Yes, even to death, even unto his death. But I want to just go back for a second to the concept of legalism. It feeds on all Christian faiths. It's not unique to just one. But I have talked to pastors of other denominations, other congregations, and I've discovered that legalism is alive everywhere. Perfectionism is alive everywhere. In fact, if you study some of the Eastern religions, Buddhism and Hinduism, you'll discover that those religions are predominantly perfectionistic and legalistic. The ultimate goal is to be pure, holy, pure, and perfect, or whatever words they use, which is legalism. Okay? If you can save yourself by purifying or by perfecting yourself, then you can become a god or whatever. Legalism teaches that you need to do all the right things and you will be saved. But I have also found that often legalism and perfectionism, it begins with a person who is highly critical. Someone who criticizes everything. Now, how do people get that way? Well, sometimes it's because they were forced or they were in a family where people were very critical and highly perfectionistic and expected too much out of them. And so they go on to grow up to become legalists, perfectionists, critical people themselves. The criticism that Paul, of course, is receiving over and over again here in the court cases or the trials that he's going through, has grown not only out of a perfectionistic society, but it's grown out of a religion that is highly perfectionistic and legalistic, and that has become a culture in itself. Some of you might be able to relate to that. Maybe you were raised in a highly perfectionistic culture. I often find that people that were raised in a highly perfectionistic culture usually rebel against that at an early age, but they often feel guilty all their lives because they rebelled against that. And eventually, maybe sometime later on in their lives, they come back. And often when they come back highly perfectionistic and legalistic. And it's sad because they feel that they now have to make up for that time period that they feel they left the faith, quotes, unquotes. I have been as a pastor for 30 some years now, and I've been in many different congregations. I've heard of many different congregations like to argue over whether there should be crosses or not in churches, which Bible is the best translation of the Bible. Is it King James? Is it New King James? Is it NIV? What Bible is the real Bible? And if you would just study how the Bible was written, you would find out that they're all translations. And they're all susceptible to some degree to words that may vary in how you see a text, which word you decide to use to translate that Hebrew or that Greek word. And it's not to say that they're flaws. It's just simply saying we have to have open minds and realize that the Bible was translated. It went from Aramaic and Hebrew and Greek to Latin to German to English. And then it was translated many times in English. And then from English to all the different languages around the world. Try explaining what a lamb is to an Eskimo. If you didn't have zoos, you wouldn't know what a seal was. Well, you might. I guess we do have them down here. But there are places, in the Midwest, and then you would say, well, a seal. And you'd go, well, you mean, is that the thing you stamp on your letter? No, a seal. It swims in the ocean. Well, what does it look like? Let's see. Kind of like a dog without legs. Ooh, that's gross. That's ugly. You see, the Bible has those areas where it's translating something, and you don't have a way to describe it. Okay? But a legalist will say that the word, every bit of it, must be followed to the nth degree. And so they will go back, and some will say, you must keep your hair long and your beard long. I've met those type. Can't cut your hair. Women are to be silent in church. Women are not to be leaders in the church. Any amens this morning on that one? No, okay, good. We just had a big big row about that recently. Big hoop-de-doo. And women can still speak in church. That's wonderful. I'm glad to hear that. Thank you, Martita, for coming up here and being so brave amongst all these men. But it's true. People will pick a text and they will say, it cannot change. It must remain the same. So they go back to the laws of Moses, and they see the laws there that, you are unclean if you touch a dead animal, and blah, 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 and they go on and on. And they will literally say, you must keep those. What they've done is they've taken something that is text or is historical or something that is social or something that has to do with a culture, and they will make that a divine law for eternity, when in fact it was never intended to be that way. There are truths in the Bible that are unchanging. Those are basic truths of God's universal laws. Those laws dictate how we live. Those laws dictate that we have gravity. Those laws dictate we have inertia. They say if you commit adultery, this will happen. Thou shalt not steal, because if you steal, you're taking something that's not. Those are basic laws. Those are basic boundaries that hold all societies to a level of sanity. And when they're broken, it becomes anarchy. It becomes insane. And we suffer from that. But often that comes because of legalism. They also find, you'll find that legalists see that they are personally responsible for the morality of others. You ever had that feeling? Well, you shouldn't do that. He should never do that. I saw him. I saw him going to that theater. They find themselves personally responsible for the purity of the church. You know, the unleavened bread and the yeast and all these texts that they quote, you know, they must stand at the door and make sure the church stays pure. That's why I got fussed at a lot as a teenager, because I had a beard and long hair and rode a motorcycle. I was not welcome at my father's church. Not because of my father, but because of a few saints that made sure they guarded the door like Rottweilers. And I was just a little more stubborn than they were, so I don't know who won anyways. I guess they did, because I don't have any long hair anymore. The other thing you'll find about perfection is that they will take their personal preferences. And this is true for both religious and non-religious perfectionists or legalists. They will take their personal preferences, and those preferences then become moral issues. I always use this example because we've all experienced it to some degree. I remember as a child growing up that we were held to a certain standard of vegetarianism. However, over in Korea, we didn't have Loma Linda Lingkets or any of those goodies. And so once in a while, we would stray from that in the summertime, and we would have fresh fish right out of the ocean. And I remember our family kind of being, you know, looked at funny because of that by another family, who, when they had sat down to eat, the kids were handed a handful of vitamins, literally a handful. And they had to eat all those before they left to go outside to play. So I remember the little boy that I was my friend, he would sneak half of them to me under the table so we could go sooner, because he hated taking those vitamins. So I would eat half of the vitamins, hence I'm healthy, right? But the point here is that they will take a personal preference and they will make it a moral issue. They will make it an issue as to whether or not you are judged as a good Christian or a bad Christian, or a Christian and a non-Christian. I think one of the classic examples maybe has been just the wearing of jewelry or the length of your skirt. In my day, it was how you dressed in church. Jeans weren't allowed, and cowboy boots weren't allowed, so I was already bad news, you know. There were so many things that you had to make sure of before you could walk into church that sometimes it was just impractical to go to church. Because you didn't have all of the things necessary, okay? The Bible, they also will push the concept that the Bible is a book of rules. And they are absolutely certain that there is only one correct interpretation. I think that's probably one of the big emphases that was brought up recently in our discussion over women's ordination in our church, and that is that there's only one interpretation, and it should be worldwide, and we should all abide by the same one. Otherwise, there is no unity in the church. Unity of God's church is not based on whether women preach or not. The unity in God's church is based upon Jesus Christ and Him crucified. That is where unity is found. And if you are chasing all these other issues that are peripheral issues, that are non-salvific issues, they are doctrines or dogma or traditions, but they are not the gospel. You got it? Okay. We can easily get tied into knots, just as the Pharisees were here with Paul, tied into knots over little tiny things like the fact that they said that he brought a Greek into the temple. And so they were after him to try to kill him because he had defiled their temple with a Greek. Oh my. So, one of the other things that I find too is, in my discussion over the last few years in certain topics, is that we often will find people who are legalistic or perfectionists refuse to see that honest differences of opinion can exist among Christians. They can exist. In fact, they will exist by pure differences of culture. And God, you know, I'm so fortunate and I'm so glad that God gave me the opportunity to grow up in four different cultures. And there's no way that those cultures are ever going to be, you know, doing the same thing ever, because culture is so deeply ingrained in us. And so the fact is that you can't expect everyone to follow or to do exactly things exactly the way you want them to do. Legalists are always right, and there's no room for variance. You ever met somebody like that? Always right. Always, always right. Never wrong. Everything, their whole Christian experience is based on whether they are right. And they often tend to draw followers. You'll very seldom find a legalist as a loner. They just don't exist well by themselves. I've seen it happen over and over and over again. Often they're church hoppers, and they'll finally find a church where they can have a following, or they can have people who are like-minded. On the other hand, if you find someone who understands the gospel, who has a personal relation with Jesus Christ, often you will find them as loners. Paul was one of them. He was so convinced, he was so sure, he was so caught up in his relationship with Jesus Christ, it didn't even matter if everybody on the face of this world disagreed with him. He was convinced of his relationship with Jesus Christ. And nothing was going to sway him. You say, well, then that means Paul was a legalist. Well, yeah, to some degree. And like I said at the very beginning, all of us have a little bit of legalism in us, so we can't be too hard on it. The fact is that we, as humans, tend to want to defend, protect, and fight for those things that we find to be true or that we believe in. But Paul can't be stopped by the legalists or their arguments. Paul's answer, I find over and over again here in the book of Acts, in these last few chapters, Paul's answer is always, "And I saw Jesus." "And Jesus called me. And he saved me, and he died and rose again for me. I am saved by a personal Christ." That's what I find Paul testifying to over and over again in his talks, his sermons, his defenses in front of the court systems. And yet, when I look at Paul's writings in Galatians, in Romans, Ephesians, some of the other books that he wrote, I find Paul as a very humble person. Humbled by the gospel, humbled by the reality that he serves a sovereign God, humbled by the fact that the Son of God, Jesus Christ, would come to this earth and die just for him. When he was lost in his perfectionism, Christ died for him. And then he cries out, "Oh, wretched man that I am, who will save me from this? Who is going to save me from my wretchedness, from my sinful condition, from my sinful nature?" And he answers the question, "Christ will. Christ will." Now, I hope I didn't step on any toes this morning about legalism. Like I said, we're all legalists to some degree. And just make sure that the legalism that you stand for, or the things that you stand for, I should say, are found in God's Word, that they are salvific by nature, that you're not chasing the devil's dogs somewhere else down some road, that you are faithful and true to the gospel of Jesus Christ, and that you always lift up Christ. Christ said, if I am lifted up, if I be lifted up, I will draw all men to me. And if you find yourself being tempted to draw other people to you, or to follow other people, then you're on the wrong road. Christ is the only one. He is the only one that can save you. He is the only one that was willing to die so that you could be saved. And He is the only one that rose victorious over sin and death. Therefore, as Paul says, nobody can convince me, not angels, not demons. Nothing can convince me. Nothing can change my mind. I'm saved. I'm saved by Jesus Christ. I just, after reading this last couple chapters, I wrote something down that I think I brought it out here with me. I wanted to share with you regarding this whole matter. There it is. Okay. I may have read parts of it before, but I've been refining it a little bit more and more as I'm going through the Gospels and also reading Paul's writings in regards to faith. Healthy faith, it says, allows me to acknowledge my humanity. There is no illusion of perfection, only a humble acknowledgement that by nature I am a sinner. Healthy faith allows me to experience God's grace and mercy, even in the midst of hardships and, yes, and trials. Healthy faith allows me, out of gratitude, to love God, to follow Him, and know that the reward is yet to come.